Tonight I wanted to just launch right into the Dharma teachings and to speak about a quality of patience. But first I want to have a sense of whether or not this is of any value to you. Does anybody already have enough patience? Already completely cultivated, don't need any more? Because I don't know if I've ever met anybody who has already feel like they have perfected the quality of patience. Sometimes I wonder if perhaps my brother has, because he seems to be one of the more patient people I know. But even he, I've seen him wish he had more patience to handle some of the things that life has us handle, whether it's patience with our own mind or patience trying to get a computer program to do what we want it to. There is a quality in the Buddhist tradition that is specifically cultivated called kanti, and that's the Pali term, it's kanti. And we usually translate it as patience or perhaps forbearance. And I want to begin with just a little story that I found in a book about tales of the wise or perhaps foolish Sufi saint called Mulla Nasruddin. And the story is that Mulla Nasruddin had saved up to buy a new shirt. So he went to the tailor's shop with his cloth, full of excitement, got himself measured, and gave instructions to the tailor to stitch up his shirt. And the tailor said, "Come back in a week, and if Allah wills, the shirt will be ready." So Mulla Nasruddin was content with that, and he contained his excitement for the week, waiting for his new shirt. And then he went back to the tailor's shop, and the tailor said, "I'm sorry, there has been a delay, but if Allah wills, your shirt will be ready tomorrow." Now the following day, Mulla Nasruddin went back to the tailor's shop, and the tailor said, "I'm sorry, but it's not quite finished. Try tomorrow, and if Allah wills, it will be ready." And so Mulla Nasruddin asked, quite exasperatedly, "How long will it take if you leave Allah out of it?" Now, those of you that have traveled in India will know that this is sort of a common experience to not only at tailor shops, but things don't always happen the way that we want them to, the way that we expect them to, the way that they think they should happen. And so patience, forbearance, becomes a virtue that we need in our spiritual lives and in our daily lives. It may not be as exciting a quality as rapture or realization or even tranquility, but most people benefit by a little bit more patience. I think it's important not to confuse kanti with passivity, reticence, or procrastination, because passivity and procrastination have an element of aversion in them, a resistance, as though we're holding back, not giving our energy to the experience. But kanti is an energetic commitment to be open as we wait. It implies a commitment to calm abiding. It has an enduring quality that is engaged. It's not at all passive. So there is a dynamic aspect to kanti that I think is important to realize in order to cultivate and develop this factor. We develop that dynamic aspect, but we don't force it. We can't force ourselves to be patient. The ability to abide with experience without demanding it be a certain way is an essential part of our practice. And it results in a warmth and a lightness and a radiance, an almost brilliance to the heart that expresses a very simple and patient life. Many disciplines other than spiritual life need patience. research, discovery, learning of all kinds require that quality of dynamic, engaged patience. Those of you that have learned to play musical instruments know you need lots of patience. But not only do you need patience, but every member of your household needs patience as you learn that same song over and over, that same scale you practice again and again. I've been for the last few years practicing ballroom dance, and sometimes I think my teacher has tremendous patience because I step on him and I haven't brought him to the ground yet, but almost sometimes tried to trip him, not intentionally. And often he has to give me the same instruction again and again and again and again, because sometimes the same instruction is what we need to hear again and again. It's not that we just do it. Sometimes we just incline a little bit in that direction. And then the next week he wants me to incline a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. I think learning to drive a car is one of those learnings that require more patience on the side of the teacher than it does on the side of the student. Both parties in any learning process need tremendous patience. I had a teacher in graduate school. I studied art in graduate school. And he was one of the most amazing educators that I have ever had. And it really brought to life a quality of investigation that has served me in so many aspects of my life since I met him. And he had a true love of learning, but his classes were rigorous, they required enormous patience and forbearance and endurance, because the basic structure of the class was an art criticism class, art critique class. So two of us, two students, would bring our art each session to the work, to the class, and the class would discuss it. They would critique the work. But his classes generally lasted 12, sometimes 14 hours. Sometimes we'd get out in 10, but that was pretty rare. So the critiques could last anywhere from 4 to 10 hours. And that required an awful lot of endurance. But he would keep looking at the work and looking at the work and questioning and investigating and staying with it until there was a sense that we had penetrated the meaning of it somehow, that we had made a breakthrough. And he had a way of tenaciously staying with something until that kind of collective breakthrough occurred and something was revealed. And that's a quality that I try to remember and bring to my meditation practice, because it's too easy to just start to think that something gets a little confusing or gets a little difficult or even gets a little interesting, and then we're up and off the cushion. If it's a little interesting, we think, oh, I just had an insight into whatever and I'm off. Can we stay with it? Can we go deeper? Can we go deeper to really allow a transformation to happen? If something's a little confusing, can we stay with it to sort it out, to tease out, well, what's really going on here? How is this affecting the body? How did it arise in the mind? What happened in the moment before? What happened in the moment after? Not to spin out into thoughts about it, but to look into it, to have the patience to stay with it. If emotions are difficult, if pain is difficult in the body, to stay with the experience in a way that's not hard and fixed and tense, but just looks into it, teases it out, starts to explore. What is this? How is it being known? What's it revealing to me? What can I learn from it? Whatever we're going to discover in meditation practice may require patience. And meditation practice can sometimes be understood as the study of the self. As one of the Zen masters, Dogen, said, to study the way is to study oneself. To study oneself is to forget oneself. To forget oneself is to be awakened by all things. To be awakened by all things is to let body and mind of self and others fall away. Even the traces of awakening come to an end, and this traceless awakening is continued endlessly. Through meditation, we train ourselves to observe. We're observing our own existence. We're observing our perceptions. We're observing our mental processes. We're disentangling the knots of our conditioning that creates patterns that cause suffering. Are we willing to stay steady, to stay present, to meet ourselves as we are, to see the truth of what we are, to see the truth of our patterns, and to sort out what is perpetuating suffering and what will lead to the end of suffering? When we observe the arising of familiar patterns, perhaps of judgment or of fear or of impatience or anxiety, can we accept the simple fact that that difficult state arose and endure the unpleasantness of it with patience? Patiently observe as it arises, as it changes, and as it passes. We watch our minds in meditation. But similarly, biologists observe nature and entomologists observe bugs. We observe to discover something. We wait, we watch. We cannot demand experience to be exciting. Can you imagine an entomologist demanding bugs being exciting? But actually, have you ever sat and watched one? Any kind of bug. People do this sometimes on retreats. They're sitting there meditating, and this used to happen a lot when I was practicing in Thailand, just because there were a lot of bugs. And I'd be sitting there meditating, and I'd feel some creepy crawly thing go by. And sometimes I'd just open my mind, my eyes, and just watch. Just watch how it moved and notice how it felt and notice how my mind reacted and just observe. Observe carefully. There was a story that I read about, it was a lovely book called The Voice of the Infinite in the Small. And it was an inspirational book that was about all small things. And so there were lots of bug stories in it, which were really delightful. And there was a story about bees. And it seems that somebody discovered that bees communicate through their dances. And that they communicate before they swarm, they communicate as they build hives and do various things. So they have different particular dances. One dance they call a round dance, and one dance is a wiggle dance. And they come to kind of decisions as a collective, as a hive, by going through these various dances until they come to the decision and then go for the swarm. Those communications, those dances, were analyzed by entomologists as forms of geometric symbolic communication so that they could try to sort out these communication patterns. Now, I don't really understand what bees are talking about as they wiggle and as they go around, but what amazed me was the entomologists who would observe and could observe carefully and precisely enough to sort out that kind of communication. It's that quality of patient watching with interest, noticing patterns, just as they notice the patterns in the bees. Can we notice the patterns in our mind? Can we start to observe that carefully and that clearly? I'm sure they didn't just see it on first glance. I'm sure they watched a long, long, long time before they were able to recognize what was happening. And sometimes it takes us a lot of observation before we understand what are the patterns that are causing suffering. What is holding, grasping in place in our minds? Why are we continuously seduced into the same reactive pattern, even though we've seen it again and again? So we need patience to endure the difficulty of the emotion, but we really need patience to keep looking in, to keep investigating it, to keep exploring it, because that's the work we have to do ourselves in the silence. It's not an answer you're going to get from a teacher. Those classes with Michael Asher was my graduate school teacher, were so valuable and had such an effect on the rest on my life. Not because he walked into the class, analyzed the work in 5 minutes, and then walked out and told us what to think about the painting. Nor did he just sit down and write an article that was a brilliant critical article on it. No, he kept our attention coming back to the work, coming back to the work, coming back to the work, hour after hour after hour, until we saw it. And that's the kind of endurance that we need in meditation practice, to keep looking. And each time we come back, can we see something fresh? Can we see it from a new angle? Can we discover something else? We've all seen bees, but we haven't looked closely enough to discover how they communicate, carefully enough, intelligently enough to discover what's happening there. So I invite you to wait, to watch this entire week. Don't expect anything to happen. There's an opportunity we have in daily life to be reminded of this, and it's the yellow light. Do you stop for a yellow light? It's an invitation to stop. Most people consider it a challenge to get through it. But actually, it's a signal to stop. And I consider those yellow lights to be opportunities throughout daily life to remember Kanti. When I was in Madras, oh, my back hurt, and I was laying down in the back of a taxi, and you know the scene. and I was looking up out the window, and I kept seeing the red light go by, and then the red light flash, and then there would be this word relax in it. Did you ever tell those of you that were in India, did you notice? They printed in English in Madras, in many of the streetlights around the city, the word relax. So each time that the red light, people were sitting behind the red light, it said relax. And I thought, that should be in every country. We need to remember that. The wish to discover something is something that I think we all share. Just even as you were all sitting here and even coming into the dining hall, there was a sense of expectancy, of having come with a wanting to discover something, a wanting to settle, a wanting to be here. I had watched some years ago a television program, a documentary on the discovery of cornflakes. And it was fascinating. It was about the biography of Kellogg's. Do you know about Kellogg's cornflakes? It's the brand of cornflakes in the United States. And it's the brand because Mr. Kellogg invented the flaking cereal. It was back a long time ago. I don't remember exactly when. 1920-ish, perhaps 1930-ish, 1940-ish. It was like somewhere around there. Nobody's gray enough. Before all of us were born. And he had the aspiration to develop a kind of cereal that didn't have to be cooked so that it could travel very easily. And up until that time, it was mostly, you know, something the equivalent of oatmeal. And they had managed to make something kind of very, very hard and granola-y kind of thing. But they hadn't made a a kind of a flaky cereal. And so he had experiment after experiment, weeks, months, it may have been years, going on experimenting with all kinds of different recipes, different mixtures, different amounts of corn, different amounts of wheat, different amounts of all these different things, different amounts of water. They pasted them, they rolled them out, they cookie doughed them, they pounded them, they did everything. They tried to shake them, they baked them, they broiled them, they grilled them, they fried them, they tried to do everything to try to figure out how to make cornflakes. Well, they didn't call them cornflakes then, but a cereal that didn't have to be cooked. And then one time they had just been working so late at night. He was so frustrated. He told everybody just to go home and they could clean the equipment in the morning. And he just locked up the experimental shop and everybody just went home exhausted. And when they came back in the morning, they started to scrape off the equipment. And what do you think they discovered was that it flaked and it actually tasted good. So they had discovered cornflakes, and then he became one of the early millionaire, billionaires, who knows what, rich people, based upon this mistake or this accident or this accidental discovery. Now, he couldn't have just jumped to that accident. That's not the way it happens. First, you try all the rolling and you try all the recipes and you mix a little bit more egg and a little bit more this and a little bit less that, and you keep trying and trying and trying. But with each attempt, he's open to discovery. He's open to seeing something new. He's open to finding something in an unexpected place. And that kind of discovery is very helpful to stay open to, because we don't know when insight will arise. It very well may not happen while we're sitting with our eyes closed. We might get up from the seat, we might walk out, and we might just happen to feel the sun on our cheek and have an understanding that goes very deep. Not just that it feels good, but really understand how perception operates right in that, to understand the interconnectedness, the nature of things. There are so many times on retreats that we have insights when we're in the dining room, just quietly eating, chewing a carrot, crunch, crunch. And we really feel the carrot, we really taste it. Well, how many carrots have you eaten in your life? But suddenly, carrotness is revealed. Now, it seems a little silly, but yeah, take the insights wherever you get them. Little ways of seeing new things fresh or seeing old things new can add a lot of vitality to our practice, because we can't go about seeking them. We can't decide, now I'm going to go have a new experience. All we can do is patiently bring our attention again and again into the present moment, to open to our own presence, to open to our experience and our minds. Too often in contemporary life, we expect things to be instant, to be fast. You know, you open a package of noodles and you mix it with hot water and there's soup. But some things really do take time. Growth takes time, healing takes time. There are many things in life that have no instant remedy or instant cure. Arts and crafts take time. Time to develop the skill and time to actually do the work. I don't know if any of you are weavers, but I have a friend who does some incredible weaving work. And it's just such beautiful, exquisite craftsmanship and takes tremendous patience. Now, my grandmother on my father's side, we called her Grammy, was a Polish descent. And so she used to cook from scratch, all kinds of stuff. You know, she'd make her own sausages, she'd make all her own bread, she'd make her own this, she'd make her own that. She was famous in the family for making incredible desserts, quite amazing strudels and cookies of all sorts that were just really extraordinary. And when she died, I was given her recipe book as a real cherished. It was a possession that she cherished because it contained much of what she gave to family and the world in terms of her cooking and her preparations. But I have to admit that I have almost never used her recipe book because most of the recipes take far more time than we put into it generally in our life. Many of the recipes take multiple days to prepare. You know, to prepare the dough a certain way and this and that and then let things mature to a certain point. And it requires tremendous patience. And when I look at that recipe book, I often feel great appreciation for her and a little bit of sadness that life is so pressured nowadays that it's hard to take any time to do something as simple and as joyful as to bake fancy cookies. Really fancy cookies, you know, with the little stuffing that has to be cooked on one day so that it cools and da-da-da-da-da, just all these little things. Well, outside of the kitchen and the meditation hall, many things sent in nature require a lot of patience. We have a station on our televisions that are the Discovery Channel and the Nature Channel and the National Geographic channels, and they have all these wonderful shows about animals that I really enjoy watching. And there was a show I watched about tigers. Tigers, of course, are very powerful animals, but they don't run long distances. So they have to be very, very close to actually get their prey. So they often wait in ambush so that their prey will get close to them, and they just do a quick dash and then pounce. But do you know that they are successful less than 1 in 20 attempts? And because they wait in ambush, they can wait. You know, they can set themselves up like in the grasses or on the trees, and they can wait for a long time. And if the herd that they're stalking moves in another way, even if they've just been waiting for hours and hours, you know, they just have to go to another thing. If they dash and they don't get their prey, the whole herd is gone. And that may be, you know, another day or two before they have another opportunity to even try. And they count these, you know, how many times does it take for a tiger to get lunch? And they say it's more than 1 in 20 times. There is a patience, a willingness to endure that requires this forbearance in the natural world. And it's very present, I think, in many aspects of the natural world. But sometimes when we live in urban environments, we get lost in our own calendars, our own schedules, our own demands. Wake up in the morning and the first thing we do is not, sometimes it isn't even brush our teeth these days. Sometimes it's turn on the computer and check our emails. We sometimes launch right into things and then have fast communications and expect an immediate response, want more of this or less of that, and in some ways kind of keep inclining ourselves towards this immediate response, immediate gratification. But does this process really make us more content, or does it just make us more demanding? There was an ad I saw some time back, but it fits so perfectly in this. And the ad reads, "Do you multitask in the shower? Do you have to know everything first, if not sooner? Do you check your email and your voicemail while you're reading your snail mail? Is your microwave just too darn slow?" We understand this kind of obsession. And then it launches into how they're obsessed for us and how wonderful this kind of obsession is, and they'll take care of, I think it was for some financial company. But sometimes even the microwaves don't seem fast enough. I'm amazed at how, as fast as technology gets, everybody thinks that it's slow. That's just 5 years ago. What were you happy with as a pace of your internet connection? And now what are you happy with? The demands get so strong. Sometimes we want this instant noodle kind of soup in our enlightenment practice. So we might be attracted to something that sounds like instant enlightenment or an enlightenment intensive. Or there can be a fascination with teachers who apparently got enlightened, not just rapidly, but instantly without any effort at all. Many, many students tell me, I don't have time to meditate. Well, everybody has 24 hours in a day. Everybody does. We all have time. It's a question of how do we use it? What do we do with it? So when we gather together in a group like this, it immediately inspires a sense of respect, a sense of joy, a sense of honoring that you really have set aside a lot of preoccupations and you are taking the time to develop the mind. Do you taste the power of that decision? Do you sense the strength of that intention? Sometimes we have to look at our lives from a perspective of quiet. Sometimes we'll sit down and we'll just feel so much stress, such deep stress. And we have to reflect and think, well, is this really how I want to live? Or is there something that I need to change in my life? Emails are something I struggle with a lot because for a long, long time, I refused to have an email address. But at some point, it became impossible, simply impossible, to be a Dharma teacher without lots and lots of email communications, multiple hours a day. Simply was impossible. Nobody would invite me to teach because people refused to pick up the phone and call me. They would only send an email. So that amazes me because wouldn't you think that this profession of any could get away with not being obsessed about the computer? But it can't. It can't. And I sometimes remember how beautiful the communications were when I lived in India and would send a postcard. Like, I'd write really, really small and get a big postcard and write, like, a really detailed stories and share questions and ask insight, all kinds of things to friends back home. And then they would send a letter or a postcard back, and then I would send another one. And we would have in-depth, profound conversations that would have like a month in between. And that kind of gap allowed a deepening and a maturing, not just of the relationship, but of the reflection and of what we were talking about. A lot of that Dharma conversation was what was held in that in those postcard exchanges, that it just is so rare to find it when we have to shoot off an email as quickly as possible. I saw a statistic. I don't know what the statistic is in Israel, but in the United States, during the first 30 years of our lives, we stand in line for 8.5 weeks. Imagine that. I don't know if it's more or less here, but it's a massive amount of time that we stand in lines. Are we calm and at ease in that waiting? Or are our minds obsessed with what's going to happen when we get to the front of the line? Are we preoccupied with dread, with hope, with worry, with expectation, with idealistic fantasies or worst-case scenarios? There are many things that we wait for. Perhaps not in line all the times. Sometimes we have to wait for test results. That might be an exam in school, or it might be the results of a biopsy or a medical procedure. How do we fill those gaps when we wait? It's very interesting on a retreat to explore waiting if you're scheduled for an interview. And in the moments before, when what happens in your mind? What happens in your heart? What happens in your emotion? Can you allow that waiting time? Especially if the previous interview is going late or something, or the group is going late and you have to wait. What is happening within you? Can that be a time to rest at ease in a pure and clear presence? Or is it a time when we get anxious or demanding? We learn to wait in meditation practice, and we wait with grace. So that we learn to let go of the tendency to keep torturing ourselves with demands and thoughts and preparations and rehearsing and planning what we're going to say and planning what we're going to do. A friend has a t-shirt at home that says, "Worry is not preparation." So often we'll sense in our lives that we're worrying, that we're adding stress to a situation. And the stress doesn't actually help us handle the situation. And we can tease out that difference between a difficult situation and the extra worry. The more clearly we see it in our meditation practice, the more quickly we'll be able to identify that in the complexity of an active situation at home. And then we'll be able to let go of just the worry and stay present in the difficult situation. If we can't tease them out, we may then try to avoid difficult situations, try to withdraw, or try to find some kind of utopic situation to live in, which, good luck, it's just not on this planet. So we tease out what is the cause of suffering, and we learn to let just that part go, that extra worry, that extra suffering. Many of you, I think, will have had many experiences of training yourself in patience. When I was in India, I learned that patience is one of the great lessons that travel in India provides. You just have to take a train somewhere. How often are the trains running on time? You know, they might like to depart their original place on time, but then each stop along the way, this and that. I've sometimes been standing on the platform for 12, 14 hours before the train actually came. Another area to explore has to do with how much we demand of ourselves, how judgmental we are of ourselves, how we might expect ourselves to, I don't know, get enlightened this week, solve a problem, have an enormous breakthrough. Sometimes we have great expectations and we find that we come into the meditation hall and we're just planning some silly thing we want to do or rehearsing some conversation we're going to have. And so that's what we get. That's what we get. And it isn't that there is some great spiritual experience that we try to achieve. This practice isn't about achievement in that way. This practice is just about acceptance and letting go. It's about opening to what is with wisdom. Authentic presence isn't in a hurry. So if you find yourself rushing on this retreat, trying to make something happen very quickly, let go. Settle in. Let go of the demand. Now, chances are the only thing that you're really going to want to rush to is lunch. But even that, it will be there when you slowly, mindfully find your way to the dining hall. We'll need to have patience with pain in the body. But even more, we'll need to have patience with pleasure. And we'll need to have patience with neutral feelings. sometimes long stretches of experience that doesn't quite feel pleasant and doesn't quite feel painful. We think nothing's happening. We get bored. Can we just open to that without grasping, without dulling out, without avoiding? To be willing to be present for our experience, just as it is. We also wait for the right time for things. There's a sense of being present, settling in, but also knowing when there's an opportunity. And coalescing our energy around certain opportunities that we have. Now, there are lots of examples in nature of bacteria and spores and insects that lie dormant for a long time until conditions arise for them to, conditions come together for them to grow. There are lots of animals that hibernate through the winter. And there are beetles that wait for years and years and years before their eggs hatch because conditions have to come together in just a certain way, a kind of quality of moisture and warmth over a certain period of time. And they could stay in the ground for 1, 2, 5, 10 years before those conditions come together. But when they come together, they hatch. I was watching on this Discovery Channel an example of, you don't mind hearing about American TV, do you? A little stereotypical, but... You have Discovery too? Oh, good. It's a lovely channel, isn't it? And you don't watch it. Well, maybe you saw this one then about the frogs that spawn in the desert in Africa and they bury themselves underground. Did you see that one? It was incredible. They bury themselves underground until the rain comes. And then they do all their frog-like things. But then the rain goes away, you know, and they like have a puddle for a very short period of time, which is their world. And then they go back underground and just sort of like are hibernated down there. There was one, I think this was an extraordinary animal called, it was a snake, but it lives on a very barren island off the coast of Australia. And there is so little life on the island that this snake has adapted to eat a particular bird that migrates through and builds nests on that island for its chicks. So it comes through once a year, builds nests, they sit on their nests, the little eggs crack open and the little chicks wander around. And for about 2 to 3 weeks, there are chicks that can't fly. And so they are perfect meal for the snake. So the snake, to survive, has to eat about 8 little chicks. And then they wait another 11 and a half months for their next meal. Can you imagine? And we don't want to give that idea to the cooks or anything here. But talk about patience and extraordinary aspects of nature. This human mind is an amazing thing as well. This human mind, this human body, the human capacity to feel, to empathize, to be self-aware, to explore our own minds. And just as the frog can wait for the puddle and the snake can be patient for its next meal, I think we need to be patient to sit on our cushion, to keep coming back into the hall, to keep doing the walking meditation, to keep persisting in our meditation practice, even when we don't see changes day by day. We still can just trust that it's worthwhile. It's too easy to give up because we demand rapid progress. I guarantee you, you will not make progress as rapidly as you want. We always want things to be faster and quicker and easier and more pleasant than life is. But it does happen that when we look back after some years, perhaps after some days, that we've learned something and we suffer less. Things that at one time used to catch us up and put us in a turmoil of anguish would really just be okay. We can meet them with wisdom. If you want things to be perfect, let it go. They won't be. We need this resolve, we need this forbearance to sustain our commitments, even when wisdom and compassion and insight seem elusive and far away. It requires tremendous patience just to stick with it. But I found again and again and again that the Dharma does unfold within us. The conditions do come together so that we understand how we cause suffering and how we can end suffering. Walking meditation practice we'll speak about tomorrow, but I just want to mention in the context of patience that it's a practice of slow walking and it may take a lot of patience to settle into it. I came to love walking meditation practice when I was staying in the monasteries in Thailand and would do it for hours every day. Sometimes 2, 3, 4 hours at a time, and found it to be a tremendously beautiful, insightful, powerful form of meditation. So I hope that you'll give it the chance to reveal its beauty to you, its power to you, its usefulness to you. And to do that, you'll have to slow down. There'll be times when you'll go faster, that's where the energy will be, but it will be a slow nudging of just dropping into, can I slow down a little bit more? Can I notice a little bit more clearly? Can I open just a little bit more? Many things that we'll experience are not going to be very spectacular. Often our expectations are not realistic. But I encourage you to just slow and be with the simple things, the simple sounds that we hear in nature, among people, passing cars. Just open to the simple again and again, to not demand that our understanding and our realization occur around something that looks or feels or conforms to a spiritual notion. It's often the simplest things are really where the revelation occurs. I attended an Indian film festival that was of the work of Satyajit Ray, who is an old, these are old films. I forgot how old, let's say 50s-ish. Does anybody know him? To know, is that around 50s? That's about right. Okay. Very exquisitely beautiful films. Exquisitely beautiful. And not very much happens in them, especially compared to the action-packed, dazzling, computer-generated, all that stuff that we have now. But it was so riveting, the extraordinary depth and beauty of the filming and of the slow, slow pace and the interactions, incredibly beautiful. And sometimes I see how quickly we move from thing to thing to thing to thing. And I think of those films and I think, oh, we just haven't given the time to really look into the very simple, deep relationships that occur in and get explored in some of those old, beautiful films. The bad news is that one of the best ways to develop Kanti is with obstacles and difficult, painful situations. So if you want more patience in your life, welcome the obstacles. Learn to endure them. And the Buddha said that there are some things that are best dealt with by enduring. There were some things that he said that are best dealt with by avoiding, some that are best dealt with by knowing, some that are best dealt with by enduring, some that are best dealt with by investigating. There's a whole big bunch of different things that, you know, you take different tactics toward different situations. But I want to just read you the paragraph that he says, what taints should be abandoned by enduring. Here, a bhikkhu reflecting wisely bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing and menacing to life. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there is no taints, vexation, or fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. Now, some people read this or hear this and they think, oh, I'd much rather avoid all of those. Why didn't he put those in the avoid category? But he didn't. These are the ones that if we continuously avoid contact with the unpleasant, the result will be a weakening within us, not a development of clarity, patience, and a freeing of the mind from the causes of craving and suffering. So we undertake patience as a specific spiritual training, and undertaking that commitment to develop greater patience, we then know, oh, this is uncomfortable, this I can bear, and in that bearing, I'm not growing tense and hard and tough, but I'm softening into that experience to open to it, to develop patience. Monastic practice, I found to be, living in the monasteries, to be very much about patience, a calm, enduring, steady presence with things. In the monasteries, we did several practices that fall under the Dutanga category, or what's called the shaking off practices. They're very mild austerity practices, such as, walking barefoot in the forest, or choosing slightly more. The normal practice is to not eat afternoon, but one can make a commitment to eat only a certain amount, or not more than a certain amount, or to mix all the food up so that you can't taste anything good, or to eat only one meal a day and not have any breakfast. There are other ways that you just sort of up the ante of the renunciation practices a little bit once the normal monastic life gets easy and comfortable. These practices were not intended to be a form of suffering or penance. It was simply to keep challenging ourselves to continue to cultivate patience, to continue to free the mind from reactions, to learn to endure. So we consider the reasons why we undertake practices. Sometimes it's, the Buddha listed a number of reasons not to do Dutanga practices. And he said it's not for penance, to burn off bad karma. It's not for fame. It's not to impress anybody. It's not for gaining a reputation. It's not out of peer pressure to belong because other people are doing it. And it's not to attain a better rebirth or a better state in the future. But we do them for the benefits of simplicity, to be content with few wishes and few needs, and to develop strength and resilience within us. We use obstacles to strengthen our practice. This strength of practice, this compassion, brings forth the quality of compassion that allows us to endure difficulties with that ability to wait. This allows us to actually be of service, to actually help. We don't know when conditions will mature for any particular understanding or any particular opening. All we can do is stay present. You've planted the seed by coming here. You plant the seed of intention with the wish to awaken, the wish to cultivate mind and heart, the wish to understand the nature of things, the wish to realize the end of suffering. So we water that seed. We let it grow warm with like a seed planted in a field that's warmed by the sun. I think as a community, going through a schedule of sitting and walking, we keep that nurturing, that seed, until at some point it sprouts, and at some point it flowers, and at some point that flower opens. But we don't ever rip the petals open on the flower. We don't force the heart to open, and we can't make an insight happen. We can instead nurture the conditions and be present for that opening when it does happen. So in essence, we wait. We watch, and we enjoy the unfolding of awareness, the unfolding of the Dhamma as it occurs. Let's have a few quiet minutes.